Is this on, by the way? Yes, there it is. Chairman Anderson, members of the board, I'm David Leland, Chief of the Watershed Protection Division. I'm going to introduce this item. Big Springs Ranch is a property in the Shasta River watershed that is an extraordinary source of cold water, sourcing from Mount Shasta. About a year ago, the Nature Conservancy took out an option to purchase Big Springs Ranch, which is somewhat over 4,000 acres of property, and initiated a due diligence process prior to the purchase. And as part of that process, they went to the state board and sought support for studies to look at the resources, the conditions, and the restoration opportunities for the ranch. That request led to a contract between State Board and the University of California at Davis to investigate conditions on Big Springs Ranch. That work is largely complete now, and today's item is an opportunity for you to hear the results of that work. We have with us here today Dr. Mike Diaz, who has been working very closely as part of the UC Davis team. He's a principal with Watercourse Engineering in Davis. And has worked in the Shasta watershed for 15 years, first with the community on developing some models. He worked later with us in developing the TMDL and continues to be involved up there working for on this project, on other projects with TNC, on other properties that they have there, and also with the Montague Water Conservation District. So he has quite a number of connections to the community. And with that, I will turn it over to him to make the presentation.
Thank you, David. Good afternoon. My name is Mike Diaz. I'm with Watercourse Engineering out of Davis, California. And I'd like to thank you, David, again for a nice introduction and some background so I don't have to go through it regarding the history of the property. I would like to say that Big Springs was owned by only two landowners in the last 150 years. So it was an opportunity when the Nature Conservancy could step in and purchase a piece of property for conservation that just doesn't occur very often. Anytime during the presentation, you're welcome to ask a question. Actually, Carson Jeffers from UC Davis Center for Watershed Sciences also was a project manager or principal investigator on this. He's not here today. I have Drew Nichols from UC Davis if we have any other questions about field work and things like that. I guess I can do this too. No? Do I point it someplace?
The bottom button.
Okay. This is not that important a slide. It just tells you who participated from our internal team. Jeff Mount is the principal investigator along with Peter Moyle. There's Carson, Randy Dahlgren, another professor at Davis, and then several graduate students. Watercourse has been working in the valley for, well, I've been working there longer than the company has been around, but we've also been working with UC Davis for about 5 years on various activities in the Shasta Valley in a cooperative arrangement. Acknowledgements, we'd like to thank the State Water Resource Control Board for funding the process, and also the Regional Board for helping in review of the project report, providing insight at the front end and the back end of the process. Bureau of Reclamation, they've been a large funder in the basin regarding some of our work. Fish and Game, a lot of cooperation with them for on-the-ground work. Irene Busk, who is the landowner who originally owned the ranch, and the Nature Conservancy. The location is in Northern California. It's not far off I-5 if you're ever driving up that direction. And Interstate 5 is coming right up through the middle of the Shasta Valley. It's right here. After you leave Weed and before you reach Yreka, it's approximately 5 miles or so to the east of there. Mount Shasta is here, and the ranch is located right here. What's important about Big Springs Ranch? You know, we find it hard sometimes to step in. We're very close to it, but we show up at a meeting and say, oh, it's so great. It's got this and this and this, but what's great? Why is it important? Typically, when we think about anadromous fish, salmon, steelhead, other fish like that, we're looking for a cold water supply, cool waters in the summer, for particularly for those phases of the life stages that oversummer in fresh water. And in the Klamath Basin in general, it's a pretty adverse thermal environment in the summer. What we find is that most streams that penetrate the Coast Range and come into the interior, the Russian River, the Eel, certainly tributaries to the Sacramento and the San Joaquin, can get quite warm in the summer, and the Klamath is no exception to that. So we're always looking for places where there's cool, clean water to support oversummering coho salmon, oversummering steelhead, and similar life stages. So what we have in Big Springs is a large, stable volume of spring water. Spring water is usually around anywhere between 45, 48 degrees Celsius up to about 50, 55 degrees Fahrenheit, I'm sorry. And that's what we're looking for, really. And water temperatures typically in these reaches are 75 degrees in the summer. So it's nice to find a large, stable volume coming out of the ground with very little hydrologic variability, cool water to provide lots of habitat and cold water sources for these species. The other thing that's interesting about the spring is it's naturally elevated in nutrients. It sits right on the contact between the Cascade volcanoes and the sedimentary rocks, and so it has naturally occurring in it nitrogen and phosphorus, the same stuff you put on your lawn to make it green. And that creates a lot of growth, what we call primary production in the system. And that fuels the food web, which is all the bugs that eat the aquatic vegetation, the bugs that eat the bugs, the fish that eat the bugs, the fish that eat the fish, and leads to very high fish production in the system. So the big picture here is that when we arrived on the scene a couple of years ago, the ranch was in a highly degraded condition, really due to past ranch management activities that even the local Cattlemen's Association apologized when they got a tour of the ranch. This is not the way we do business, they said. It was overgrazed, and there was not a lot of tailwater control. Irrigation management practices were not in place. And it was typical of what you see here, where there's a main canal running here, and they're just flood irrigating across here. There's a narrowing at this point right down here, which creates a large and shallow, wide impoundment, which exacerbates heating in the system. The return flows are coming back on the order of 80 to 90 degrees Fahrenheit, very warm water, when right here out of this spring we have 52-degree water. So you have a lot of potential here, and it just wasn't being realized. So just to give you an idea, another element is a simple prescription that's often used is just fencing, just keeping stock out of the creeks in general. You can have watering lanes and things like that, but unrestricted grazing has led to this wide river like this because it's probably been grazed for 130 years. And after time, you just break down the banks because there's not designated watering lanes, rotated pastures, and things like that. So here we are in April 2008, a month after the Nature Conservancy acquired an option to the property. And the landowner still could graze the cows. And there's no aquatic vegetation. We have a very wide channel, shallow channel. You can see this cow standing out in the stream. It's only 6 inches deep. By September, the cows had been kept out of this reach, and you can already see that the stream is looking for a natural channel. Aquatic vegetation has grown up. It's been trapping sediments. The stream is probably 2 feet deep. There's gravels on the bottom of it. The sand has been washed away, and this is just moving the cows out. That's all it is. And however, when the cows came back in October of that year, they were let back in this parcel, and by December, we have the same condition we started with in April. And just one simple prescription of removing the cows, managing, they can have access to these areas, but just managing them would have a great impact. So the big picture here is that the creek maintained very high resiliency. If you just could leave it alone for a little bit, it would really improve on its own. What we found is just in that period, this is that same picture from September, is we had reduced water temperatures and improved habitat. We had greater depths, we had cooler temperatures, lower daytime maximums. It was really a great learning experience. You know, a lot of times we want to restore something and get a big, you know, tractor going there and move a bunch of dirt. Here, it's just really, let's see what the stream can tell us. So the project elements, and I'm going to go through the elements of the project quickly. They're technical. You're welcome to stop me if you want more information, but I know you have a very busy agenda this afternoon. The first thing I want to talk about is our goals and our approach and our baseline assessment. We'll talk briefly about some of the data, and then we constructed a two-dimensional model for flow and temperature to help us look at restoration opportunities, which is here, and then we have a couple of conclusions and recommendations. So our goals was to complete a comprehensive baseline assessment. And now this deals with physical and biological conditions. When we come to a system, and I'm just speaking from the general scientific community, not necessarily Watercourse or UC Davis, but when you step into a system that's data poor, and almost all of our systems are data poor, I mean, that's something we have to be clear about. It's important that we break down all the elements of activities or conditions, because we don't know what the missing link is or the bottleneck is or the critical limiting factor. If we just go in and say, oh, we'll just measure flow and nothing else, we could easily miss an important temperature issue. Or you can have good flow and temperature conditions, but you lack habitat for fish. So a baseline study is looking at all the physical and biological conditions in the system. We could also add chemical conditions so that we know what's going on so we can make the right roadmap for the future. We wanted to look at temperature effects on coho salmon. That was a very important species. And then we wanted to use this model to look into the future. What if you had different rates of restoration? What would happen at 1 year, 5 year, and 20 year? Instead of what is it today and what could it be sometime in the future, we wanted to try to quantify that. So when we look at the baseline assessment, what do we have? And it was a cool picture, I thought, but it's hard to read. we have the creek and we have stream flow as a basis. We have geomorphology, which is the bed slope of the river. What's the material on the bed slope of the river? What's a cross section look like? What is it? What is the shape of it? How much power does the stream have? We have water quality, including temperature and nutrients. And we have primary production in the food web. Remember, that's the plants that grow in the stream. And then we have the fish and bugs. And all this supports a large, what we call trophic pyramid, where on top are the big guys. When we talk about trophic levels, the grizzly bear is on top. The salmon is in the middle. The plankton are on the bottom. And we really have a strong feeling that successful system-wide solutions cannot be developed without a comprehensive data set in these types of systems, and most systems, actually. So we're going to go through. We put in stream flow monitoring. We picked up different types of information regarding stream flow. There's about, just to give you an idea, in the summer, there's about 50 to 60 CFS, let's say, at the mouth of Big Springs Creek entering the Shasta River. In the winter, it's pushing 100. You know, get the Press Democrat and take a look at the flow in the Russian River. And in the summer, it's often 100. We have a whole spring coming out of the ground with almost the flow of the Russian River at times. So it's a very impressive place to go look at. And if you want to go, just let anybody know and we'll arrange a tour. So we picked up flow from a geomorphological perspective. Drew in the back of the room went out and mapped the bed. We got water surface profiles. We have a width-to-depth ratio. Again, we're looking for things like habitat. How deep is the river? How wide is the river? When you think about restoring it and it's 100 feet wide, how wide would we like to have it? Given the slope, how wide is a reasonable estimate of this? Given the bed material, is it bedrock, sand, or gravel? What would the shape of this look like under a restored condition? Here are different cross sections. You can see up in this wide impounded area, it's just like a cookie sheet. Down near the mouth, it's very narrow and deeper. All information you'd like to have as you move forward in restoration. When we did temperature, it's a little hard to see on here, but we went out and did cross sections of temperature and left instrumentation in the river so we could look at diversity left and right in the stream and longitudinally. Here's a typical temperature profile. This is the head of the spring, if you will. And as you move downstream through some spring areas, it stays cool. But as soon as the springs stop coming in, we begin to see heating. We think about coho salmon down below 18 degrees. So you can see up here at 22, it's not optimal. We had some interesting findings with nutrients, too. This is a lot to go into. But what we really found is that there's peculiarly high levels of nitrate in the springs. And when we look over here in nitrate at milligrams per liter, to find source water, groundwater with 0.3 in it, is higher than we would have expected. But the thing that when you couple that with phosphorus, and we found that we had about 0.15 milligrams per liter of phosphorus when we expected to find almost none, now we had both nutrients that were important for primary production. This means this thing is going to grow lots of aquatic vegetation. It's just like putting more and more fertilizer onto your lawn. Well, the outcome is luxuriant growth. This is the creek last summer. You can hardly see it. It daylights here and there, but it is 100 feet wide and just packed with vegetation. What causes this to occur? Abundant nutrients at the top. It's a spring creek. It's stable. There's no floods here. There's no high water. There's no low water. Just moves a few tens of CFS usually through the year, so we don't wash anything away. It's got a stable temperature regime, so the temperature here doesn't vary but a few degrees all year round, which means in the summer it's cool, but in the winter it's warm, and the vegetation persists through the winter. And this provides a lot of secondary producers, bugs, which equate to higher trophic level food sources. So the food web, not really going to go into this because this is really technical. No one ever reads this part of the report. But we looked at, are the primary producers eating aquatic macrophytes or detritus? This is just organic matter, dead material, dead plant material, or are they grazing on periphyton? And then we use this information and a method called stable isotope analysis to identify that when we look at a salmon, we see in the salmon a signature in stable isotopes of carbon, nitrogen in this case. We see that they're eating aquatic invertebrates, scuds. By the way, this is a picture of scuds. And this you don't find except when you open your fish food box and look in the fish food. This is densities that we've never seen anywhere. They're literally a half an inch thick just everywhere. And that's just fish food. I mean, they're like little shrimp, and they're just pouring through the system. You turn over a rock, and it can look like this. So we know that juvenile salmons, by this analysis, are using aquatic invertebrates, and then we can look at the aquatic invertebrates, and we know they're eating organic matter. And we know that they're eating this pool of organic matter, detritus and cestone. So when these things peak, help us understand where we want to take this system under restoration. What are the food sources, and what's important about the chemistry and flow in this system regarding restoration? So when we look at fish abundance, there were habitat surveys done looking for the potential habitat. Last year in May 2008, all of the zero-plus coho, so briefly, coho come in, adult coho, they spawn. Those fish are called zero-plus. They must reside in freshwater for 1 year. So they need to spend the summer in a cold spot. And that's why Big Springs Creek is important for coho salmon, because it provides cold water refugio over the summer. So they were located within 15 meters below Big Springs Dam. So we have a 2.2-mile creek, and all of the fish in that creek were within 15 meters of the dam at the top, where the springs come out of the ground. Because as you move downstream, the channel was degraded, wide, shallow, no cover, no habitat, and warmed quickly from return water flows and solar radiation. So there was no other place for them to be except in this one small pool. So you can see this is distance along the creek. This is the mouth of Shasta River, and as you move up, and this is time along here. You can see all the fish are at 3.5 kilometers, about 2.5 miles up, all stacked in there. There are about 200, 250 fish in this area, about the size of this little alcove right here. And they didn't move at all. They stayed there for months. But when you look at the size of the fish that come out of here, they're giant. We were having zero-plus fish, and Carson Jeffers was presenting at the American Fishery Society in Portland and showing this picture, and people saying, no, that's a one-plus. That fish is a year old. It's in its second year of life. He said, no, these are all zero-plus fish. They're so large. And typically, this fish would be about half that big, and their body weight would be much smaller than half because they're just chunky, because all they do is sit there and eat shrimp all day. You know, that's all they do. So why? Shrimp are good. fresh, cold water. So we have the physical conditions. We got lots of water, and it's cold. We have chemical conditions. It's got lots of nutrients. The biological elements are there, you know, to help us build the food web, to feed these fish, and the fish are there. And it culminates in perfect habitat for producing large, healthy fish in a system. So what we did is we extended this baseline knowledge. And, you know, I'm summarizing here in 15 minutes, but it was a lot of work. And a lot of information is out there. The report is there. You're welcome to dig through it. And really, if you do have questions, please contact us. We'd be glad to talk to anyone more about any of the details. So what we did is we took some of the basic information, like the geomorphology, and we augmented it with surveys, and we developed a two-dimensional model. Now, you know, one dimension is just in a straight line, two dimension is left and right, and three dimension is left, right, and up and down. We didn't, the creek is so shallow that we didn't see a lot of variability vertically. Pardon me, but we did see a lot of variability down the stream and left to right. So we constructed a model, and this is a little bit hard to see, but this is, first we built a topographic map field survey. It's just like a USGS map, which is a very small area of the world. And then we fit all these little polygons to that, and that is our numerical model mesh. That's our numerical grid. Where we don't need a lot of detail, the mesh is big, and where we need a lot of detail, it's very small. And every time one of those lines cross, we get input out of the output out of the model. We use this to produce longitudinal temperature gradients in the system. Here's Big Springs at the dam at the top. This is mean daily temperature right down the middle. This is the maximum daily temperature, and this is the minimum daily temperature. And these are simulations, the dashed lines on top and bottom in this, and these are the observations that we had longitudinally in the stream. So first we tested our model to make sure that it was working right, and we felt confident in it. And then we went ahead, and we started looking at what would we do. And this was a really a group exercise, and I mean, we couldn't put everybody's name on the slide because we do have technical meetings in the Shasta Basin, and we ask, well, what do you think? What should we do? And people say, well, you should narrow it. You should put trees by it. You should deepen it. Well, that's the beauty of a model. We don't have to go out there with a D8 to do it. We just sit down at our computer in the office and change the shape of the channel and see what the outcome is. So what we had today, for example, is, well, last year, we had some cows out there eating all the aquatic veg, but if we left it in after a couple years, it would begin trapping sediments and narrowing the channel, and ultimately we would have a much narrower, deeper channel, and we would have gotten through any sand and gotten into gravel, and we'd have some riparian shading too. So that's the concept, and then we put that in the model, and what we did is 3 years of restoration. What would happen after 1 year if you just left it alone? You're not going to grow big trees, you're not going to resolve all your problems. In 5 years, what would you have? You'd have cattails and things like that. And in 20 years, you'd have full-on bigger trees that were providing shade. The channel would be narrower. And then we went through and looked, and we said, well, and we also had one other thing at our disposal. We could modify the flow a little bit. We could choose not to irrigate quite so much and put the water in the creek. And so we have two cases on here. We have a base case, actually, the blue line. And then we said, well, if we had the minimum flow available to us, and we just left the creek alone, we'd get about a degree Celsius, about 2 degrees Fahrenheit, off the creek down at the mouth. If we put all the water that was at our disposal back in the creek, we could get another degree and a half. I know this is in C, but about a degree Fahrenheit. So you get, you know, 3 degrees Fahrenheit down here and a little less as you move up. Again, this is an area of large spring inflow, so it's got, you know, springs coming in here. That's why it dips and it warms and another spring comes in and then there's no more springs and we see this heating. So if you step out to 5 years, I'm going to go back up there really quick. Remember, so just so you remind you, we're right here at maybe 21. Now we get down to around 20. So 2 degrees, 4 degrees Fahrenheit, 3, 4 degrees Fahrenheit, we knock off of that. But if you look at this 18-degree line, if we use that, I don't even want to start with what coho salmon need because however many fish biologists are in the world, that's how many opinions there are. So I'm just going to use 18 as a benchmark. But, you know, you've got another 500 meters of temperature habitat here that if you could restore the habitat, you'd be doing much better off. Instead of having fish just limited up here, you can start to reach downstream. And if we go out 20 years, we can see that really, you know, we can make the whole creek in good shape. And that's I think, the value of using a model. And the assumptions are we've narrowed the stream, we've deepened the stream, and we've shaded the stream. All that's documented in the report, and again, you can ask questions about it, but I just want to quickly go through that. So after we did that, we came up with a handful of conclusions. This thing was really in poor shape. Probably one of the highest degraded reaches in the valley, probably in the Scott Valley too. The baseline assessment was really important, round everything out so we knew what the heck was going on. Because when we start thinking about prescriptions, we don't want to miss something. That's probably the take-home bullet point. The creek has amazing resiliency. And even this summer, is the differences of getting the cows out for good, essentially, is phenomenal. The changes are rapid and appreciable and notable and all in the positive direction. So it's great to have that happen. And the flow and temperature modeling helped us look at passive and active measures. Passive is just doing nothing. Active is going in and saying, we're going to narrow the channel. Physically going to narrow this. We're going to take this out. We're going to do this. So our recommendations are pretty much boilerplate from most of what we would do. We think continuing baseline monitoring is important to capture the interannual variability. We have 1 year. We don't know what happens in wet years, wet summers, hot summers, things like that. It's also really important and becoming more and more important in these economic times to have pre- and post-restoration data to illustrate, yes, we spent X amount of dollars and it did work, or we spent X amount of dollars and it didn't and we need to do something different. It's okay not to, if it doesn't work, in my opinion, but we have to be able to learn from that and move on. And if you don't have data beforehand and afterhand, you can't do that. And I think a lot of people don't pick up data beforehand because they're afraid it might not show anything. We shouldn't be afraid on that front. We want to extend baseline assessment processes and monitor to other portions of the Shasta. Big Springs Ranch is great, but it is an island right now. Coho salmon cannot move safely from that point to the Klamath River at this point. It is too warm in downstream reaches. You know, I shouldn't say that. Today they probably can. This cool weather front's coming through, and if there's fish up there and they want to get out, they can probably make it. But come August, they're on an island. And I think that maybe they were on an island before anybody ever came to the basin. I don't know that for a fact. But we shouldn't think of our individual restoration activities as little pieces in a box. But how do they fit into the basin? And that's the Shasta Basin, and that's the Klamath Basin. And then we want to continue to refine and apply the existing numerical model, because there's lots of activities we want to do out there. There's bridges, there's constrictions. Do we want to take those out? It's very expensive to go in and chisel out a big hunk of concrete when we can make a model run this afternoon and see what the implication would be. So with that, I'll take any questions.
Okay, thank you. Mike?
Yes, the damage to the river that's been done over the years, and you have high temperatures in the lower part, I guess, and you have a plan for restoration. Does that include any in-stream structures? I mean, is the habitat, you have natural structures that exist now?
There are
salmon usually require, you know, resting, spawning.
Right. We just really, I mean, the Nature Conservancy closed the deal this spring, and already people are thinking, should we put woody debris in the channel, you know, a root wad or other
boulders
to provide structure. And I think that those are questions we're all asking right now. What's nice about it is if you put boulders or structure in Big Springs Creek, it's there forever. If you put it in the Shasta River, next time there's a flood, it's downstream, and it may or may not be functional. So it's a really neat place that you can do something and it stays. But we don't want to get out in front of ourselves.
Right. You need to cure the creek, river itself first, from the outside in. Like you said, it needs to wear the channel to where you got a finished product. Then you're ready for structures, I guess.
Right.
Is the gradient of the river good enough to sustain quality structures?
I
mean, apparently, if you have some natural structures in there now, I'm assuming that it does.
You know, I don't really know where we're going to take all this. I mean, those are right on the money questions. You could be in one of our technical groups because they're asking these kind of questions.
Yeah, okay, great. It's probably just haven't got that far yet.
Yeah, we're just getting going.
Yep.
Yeah, Mike, on one of your slides, we were talking about the stable hydrology. The hydrograph that you showed shows it pretty variable, and I'm assuming that's just from irrigation coming on and off.
Well, the hydrograph we had was from 08, so existing irrigation practices were in place.
Right.
And so there's quite a bit of movement in the hydrograph.
What is you know, I'm assuming that there's some seasonal variability to what's coming out of the spring, but what are we looking at for a typical discharge?
Well, you know, that's interesting you bring that, because the Water Master reports from the Department of Water Resources, when you read their records, they always say that Big Springs has a seasonal increase late in the summer, they felt, in response to snowmelt off of Mount Shasta. We can't find that. We can't find that particular element. We don't know what that part is. We are, with UC Davis, sourcing the water. We're trying to find out where it's coming from.
Right, that's what I was going to ask, if you've done any isotropy on the water to check the age or to look at a source signature.
And UC Davis, I think in cooperation with Caltrout, has actually done quite a bit of work on the other springs in the area. So the big springs in Mount Shasta City, some on the McLeod, and others have been explored, and they actually even know the recharge areas on Mount Shasta where those springs come from. We haven't, I think the samples have been taken, but I don't think we've got the information back for Big Spring.
Sure. Thanks.
This may not be necessarily a question for you, but what is the ownership of Big Springs now, the ranch? Is it gone all the way over to the Conservancy, or is it still somewhere in between?
There were about 4,400 acres. The original owner retained 400 acres where her home is and a small cattle operation. The remainder is owned by the Nature Conservancy.
So it has gone over and it
yes.
is? Okay. One other. At one point, and I'm working on my memory now of about a year or year plus, our staff, and so I'm probably going to put Brian on the spot, but the we were looking for, I believe, 80 CFS of cold water, which we felt would have a very major bearing, and we were looking at Big Springs. Will this do that?
I don't remember the right exact number, you know, the CFS.
45.
This goes farther toward it than anything else I could imagine doing. Yeah, it's a good step.
If the water can remain in the stream.
Yeah. I mean,
there are water right issues that are going to need to be resolved.
There, and the issue is, even if you took all of Big Springs today and put it back in the Shasta River, you would still have temperatures that were not amenable to coho in the lower river.
Mm-hmm.
So, I look at it as this refugial area. Like, you can go there and stay there, and some of these species are very adapted to that, and this occurs throughout many river basins where fish actually move up into cold water, stay, they're isolated. But we're thinking, you know, what are the ramifications when you can run 18 degrees out the mouth of Big Springs Creek? That means you're going to have a much better steelhead fishery downriver because they can tolerate higher temperatures. In good years, you're going to have an expanded habitat because in good years, last year we did have coho salmon rearing in the Shasta River below Big Springs Creek all summer. That doesn't happen very often. One of the things is, when we create a solution through a restoration action, it's not static, but we got 6 miles of habitat back. We get 6 miles in a wet year. We get 2 miles in a severe extended drought. We get 3.5 miles on average. And you're looking at this variable process, but that fits very keenly in with the variable dynamics of, for example, anadromous fish histories. They come and go, and there's bigger runs and smaller runs. We just want to make sure there's enough so that we have a robust solution to our problem and can move these fish from this precarious position where we can't find a single coho in Big Springs Creek this year to times when we say, wow, we've never had under 1,000 juvenile coho for the last 10 years. That would be great.
Thank you. The question in terms of more data is needed to better understand the system before are you prepared to make recommendations? Do we have enough data to make recommendations of what should be done, or do we await 2 more years, 3 more years of data collection?
Well, I think you can always cautiously move forward, you know, with information in hand. And we actually, you guys at the regional board here, do that all the time. You know, 303 the listing process is like that. One of the interesting things is when you just leave the creek alone. Let me back up. For channel restoration, a lot of times what happens is we hire some consultant. They come in and they go, oh, we need between here and there, six meanders. The stream should be between 30 and 45 feet wide, and it should be 2 to 3 feet deep with velocities of 2 feet per second. That's great. And many times we have no idea whether that's right or wrong, but here we can let it sit, at least for a summer, and it actually builds the meander channel right in the big wide channel. All the vegetation comes in. It builds a little meanders. It deposits material where we never thought it would, and we're taking that information and saying, oh, that's interesting. We can use this information to begin planting and restoring certain areas where the river is telling us it should be. So certain things can be done immediately. The longer-term questions are more along the structure. If we went ahead and put woody debris in today, the river may just bury that over on some side bank and we'd never see it again. So I think from a thermal perspective and from the hydrology perspective, one thing we do see, for example, is springs often lag dry periods. So we might get out into 2013 and find out our production at a Big Springs Creek is a little lower even though it was a wet year. Those are the kind of questions that we want to continue to enrich our background with, but we can move forward immediately with riparian planting, removal of bridges or obstructions in the creek. You know, if there was a place to augment gravel because we thought we might get some spawning, that might be some things you do. But I think it's a continuum. We're going to make decisions from now forward.
And the material that, if you let it stand, it fills itself in. Where's that material coming from?
You know, this is it, you just think, how could there be any more sand in the system? You know, but there is a ton of sand in the system from the banks. It will not fill in everything. Some of it will fill when the vegetation grows. The sand gets captured in it, and it will take then multiple years where cattails will grow. They'll fall, decay. Other material will wash in, and you'll slowly build those banks up. But at the same time, when it narrows and begins to erode in the main channel, that material is suspended, gets put out on this little internal floodplain, and is settled there too. But there will be places where we find down the road that we don't have enough material to adequately build banks. What we don't want to do, for example, is do a prescription where we remove a constriction and wash a bunch of material out of the stream and into the Shasta, because we want to keep it in Big Springs Creek so that we can use it for bank building material.
And the cattle, what's happening this year in terms of, have they been removed or they're fenced out?
They're fenced out. The easement portion, which is retained by the original owner, there are some cattle watering lanes or watering facilities, but the Nature Conservancy has a 10-meter setback, and they have fenced that, and then on their property, the Nature Conservancy's, there's no cattle access except maybe for some watering lanes and things like that. So they are essentially absent. They used to actually get in the stream and graze on the aquatic vegetation and remove it, and by removing it and pulling it up, it immobilized that sand and that moved out of the system.
And not sure quite how to ask, but in terms of the nitrogen and phosphorus being a beneficial contributory to fish production, it's not kind of the same way we hear coming out of other areas where it's a problem. So how do you square it where it's a problem some places and it's a good thing here?
What would be an example of a problem area?
Well, I think if you just go north upstream into the Klamath.
Okay. There's a critical element. I mean, when you stand, again, if you took the standard Nature Conservancy tour and you stand below Big Springs Creek looking upstream and you look down at the Shasta River, it'd be just like looking into the Klamath. Luxuriant benthic and aquatic macrophyte growth, just unbelievable. I've got colder water in the Shasta, but that's not the real crux of the issue. It's part of it, but there's no disease in the Shasta. There's no microcystis. Ceramics of Shasta. We don't have that problem. And so when you remove the disease problem, it's a different world. It's super productive. And super productive needs lots of nutrients and a little bit of temperature, maybe more than you'd like. But if I can eat enough as a fish, I can survive. So in the Klamath, though, man, I've got a really untenable disease issue. and I've got water temperatures that are a little warmer than I'd like to have, and I don't have any relief. I've got some thermal refugia scattered like, you know, stepping stones down the Klamath at the mouth of little creeks that come in cold. There's modest habitat, maybe not the best habitat, maybe not the right temperature, you know, maybe not all the things that Big Springs is. Persistent, cold, large volume, year-round, stable, you know, productive, things like that.
In your model on trees, what kind of coverage do you show? I mean, the cartoon version has a tree here and a tree there kind of thing.
Right.
Out 20 years, do you have enclosed canopy or what kind of?
We never closed it up. I think it would probably be akin to what we did in the Shasta, where maybe 50% of the bank has got trees. They're on the edge. We don't assume that it's overarching and covering it. So you're knocking probably anywhere from 30 to 60% of your solar radiation off the system as a conservative estimate. If you sought to reduce the width and aggressively plant trees and create a closed canopy, you could get more in theory. This would be a place where a little bit of research would be necessary. We're not sure. You know, it's really hard to plant a tree. I mean, I know fruit trees, you just buy them bare root and put them in the ground and water them and they grow, but when you think about it, it's pretty magical that a tree ends up where a tree ends up. And when you try to put a willow someplace, sometimes it just doesn't take. So I don't know how well that will work out if we wanted to be aggressive about shade. And then what do you want from the stream? If you shaded the stream completely, you'd reduce primary production because you wouldn't have the same amount of sunshine. That could reduce your food supply. You know, there's a balance here. And again, that goes back to the baseline assessment. You want to get all those pieces in, you know, into your toolbox so that you can ask questions back and forth among the pieces, and you can really be critical, introspective, so that you don't do something that produces an outcome that, you know, you didn't really want.
Okay. Jeff?
Was the water right transferred to the Nature Conservancy?
Yes. There's still, though, a lot of water right issues to be addressed.
And then are they applying for in-stream use of it? Or?
You know, you'd have to talk to the Nature Conservancy. Okay. That's their area.
David?
Mike, I want to thank you first for the information and everybody that worked on it. I know it's not just you, but thanks for coming here today. Can you address some of the man-made structures on this reach? I mean, there's talk in here about a water wheel, and you talk
right.
about a dam. Can you address some of those and maybe describe
David,
a little bit?
I'm sorry, I didn't recognize you.
That's okay.
There are bridge crossings that facilitated moving cows and materials back and forth across the creek, and they're pinch points. The creek is much narrower at those locations. And then there's a water wheel, which was actually used to create power in a mechanical sense, that has created a large, shallow area behind it. And, you know, on first blush, we thought we should take that out. You know, that is a narrowing, and that maybe we don't want that there. And then we find out from Carson and Drew, who were up there last week, that the entire impoundment is full of vegetation. This is not it, but like this. And the temperatures are cold because all that vegetation extending a foot or two above the water is cooling it. And all of a sudden you say, maybe you don't want to take it out. It is a passage problem for juvenile fish, it appears. We're not sure yet, but it appears that very small fish on the order of maybe an inch and a half tend to hang out below it when they are younger in March. And not until they get to some critical size, it appears, can they get over it. Well, that strands them downstream in that part of the curve where the temperature was coming up. And that may be an undesirable process. We're working with Fish and Game on passage issues there.
Is this dam part of the water wheel structure?
Yeah.
It is?
Yeah.
And from that standpoint, too, describing the property and just kind of that localized watershed around this headwaters of where these springs come out of the ground, is the flood irrigation is all on-site or was on-site past tense?
Yeah.
Is that past tense, truly?
The Nature Conservancy has done a good job to capture tailwater. There's still flood irrigation is the primary mechanism, and the Nature Conservancy wants to retain agricultural practices, but responsibly in the area. So they are also irrigating, and they're running cows too, but they're looking for a high bar, but they're looking for no tailwater return.
Okay.
but just reuse. This year, they're just trying to figure out how the system works. It's an ancient system that from an engineering perspective, it's an admirable exercise to put all these miles of canal in and build impoundments and bifurcations and structures. But their goal is no tailwater, and they're trying to capture the tailwater if they can, and not always successful, on the landowner who's still there inside their easement.
And as I hear it too, Mike, we have a TMDL, maybe not wish, but you know, we have a desire to have 45 CFS of cold water contribution from here, and we also want 4 degrees C of temperature depression that goes from the springs basically to the mouth, correct? And is that a 20-year goal? Can you maybe look in a crystal ball and predict how long? I actually think it's really good that you're listening to the stream per se. You're not just going in there with a D8 and thinking you know. And so, but looking at it from here, and looking at how this system that's quite old that you know we've mucked up pretty well. How long is that out there? How long do you think these goals really are? And how long until you see 4 degrees C depression in temperature from one end to the other, perhaps, given all the variables in a perfect world of Shasta Valley and Big Springs?
I don't think we'll see the 4 degrees C except down toward the mouth, because we're not going to make the springs much colder than they are. There's some stuff that could be down up there. But, you know, I think our 20-year goal was reasonable. You got to get out to there. Your only mechanism, really, unless you want to just pipe it, you know, but then you lose your habitat, is riparian shading.
You know, the one thing about riparian shade here, though, it doesn't. In just looking at these pictures and knowing that area and having trekked through there myself a couple times, this doesn't strike me as a riparian shade rich type of habitat from the perspective of what we typically see, where we have, you know, dense canopies, and
right.
This is more of a kind of a high plateau that starts stepping into the, you know, that kind of high desert up in that area. So
it does lack the gallery type forest we see on the Sacramento, you know, the grapevines filling in all the holes and really giving us powerful shade. But drive to the Montague Grenada Bridge, take a look at downstream there at the Meander property, and you know, if you get access to the Shasta River above Big Springs Creek, it's completely canopied in many places. It is just beautiful, solid riparian vegetation.
Alders or what species?
Water birch, willow are primary. We don't see a lot of cottonwood in there. We don't need those, though. The birch have been really robust among the cattle grazing, but the willows have taken a big hit. So there, and the other issue is the top portion right below the, right near the resident's house, has this really interesting willow thicket, which the stream comes into it and then just breaks into multiple channels that are about 3 feet wide and 2.5 feet deep, and it's a roof. It's just a solid willow thicket. You expect the moose to step out of it at any time. You know, as a restoration strategy, you could say, well, let's try to extend that, keep the cows out of that.
Yeah, can you take willow wattles and simply extend them up and down from there maybe and start that process?
Well, what's interesting is a beaver got in there, into that willow thicket this last year and built a dam. And do what beavers do, it was chewing up little sticks and they would float down, and they have stuck in these newly formed bars and they're growing, you know. So passive, you know, these might be really effective means to consider. And it's challenging, though. A lot of people just want to do something. I got a shovel, or I got something bigger, right, and I want to go do something. And,
right.
There's a lot. These are great questions. Everybody has really, you know, well-informed, you know, good questions. I mean, you should just come to our technical meeting.
Well, in a lot of ways, this strikes me as a diamond in the rough. I mean, in a lot of ways, this is a great gift that, you know, maybe by doing little or by doing a lot, you get quite a big bang out of the buck here with a without having to do a lot of political heavy lifting or maybe a lot of wrangling that way. And so I think to see it in that light is really important, that it's a win. It's a big win. And a last question would be, in this acquisition of property, an important property, what does that look like? Do you have any knowledge of any other properties in that area that may be following suit, or conservation easements that are active in that area, or anything else along that line?
We did, this is a long process for us. We've been working on this acquisition with the Nature Conservancy for 5 years. We did some initial work identifying high priority properties, going through them from what we would call a skeleton baseline assessment. We don't have access, aerial photos looking at water flow data and identifying what's out there. And we came to the Nature Conservancy and said, here's five properties. And Big Springs Ranch is right at the top. It's way out in front. They acquired the Nelson Ranch first, downstream of Big Springs. And then they acquired this ranch. So they have 44,000 acres plus 1,800 downstream. And there are other valuable elements in the basin. you have to look at your objective, what species you're after, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You're looking for broad aquatic system resource structure and strength for a robust solution, or are you just trying to get something off the endangered species list? So I'm going to grab that spring over there. And we've been working with Fish and Game and other people and talking a little bit to the regional board, too, about other areas that are of interest. But this is that Big Springs Ranch. There's really nothing like it. I mean, there's nothing like it.
Well, thanks again. Mm-hmm.
And Mike, you indicate the need for ongoing data collection. Is there money for? Is this a long-term project for you? Or?
It is. We have we put several grant proposals in for stimulus money and other some of the NOAA fisheries money. We have a little bit of money left over from reclamation. We have money to get us through this summer. But we're actively out there looking for, you know, stuff, because it's once we really broke it open, there's a lot of things that if we just spend a little bit of attention on them now, they'll pay off much higher dividends in the future.
Right. Again, thank you.
You're welcome.
I don't have any cards, but anybody public comment? Very good.
Thank you very much.
Come back. We'll have more questions. Go on to item two, which is a public hearing. Consider whether to affirm, reject, or modify the 303D list of impaired waters. And before we begin, I have to read something.